G'day, I'm John Costella. Welcome to the first episode of the Fields of Weirdness podcast. I'd usually be coming to you from downtown Washington, D.C., but today I'm in Billings, Montana. Why? Because it's where we're at in our road trip. We've just come from North Dakota, where we were when my book was published on Amazon just days ago. Singularity, Fields of Weirdness. It's why I'm doing this podcast, to provide some explanation, to answer some of your questions, and to start the conversation about the various topics, the various fields of interest, the fields of study that I raise in the book. And that's where the subtitle of the book actually comes from. One day over the breakfast table, I said to my wife, Sally, there are so many fields of weirdness that the book connects together. It's quite bizarre. And she said, hey, that's a good title. I said, what is? Fields of Weirdness, she said. Well, I already had a title, Singularity, but I offered to make Fields of Weirdness the subtitle, and so it is. And it's the name of this podcast. Maybe it's even better than Singularity, but in any case, that's what we decided on. And that brings me to another important point. We both feel, that the issues that I deal with in the book are too important to delay talking about, to spend months or years trying to get them out to the public. So the book and this podcast are far from perfect. I mean, I hope the concepts and content are relatively clear and clean, but honestly, the production values won't be. As you can tell from the fact that I'm bringing you this episode from our road trip. But then again, I think everyone is getting pretty blasé about content that is polished and perfected by AI. I think we've hit the turning point where people would prefer to hear real content from real humans rather than the AI-generated stuff. Now, I'm going to be talking about AI a lot, and don't get me wrong, it is capable of amazing stuff, incredible stuff, really. And hence the book and this podcast to try to explain where I'm coming from on it all. But I didn't use AI at all in writing the book, and I don't use it in this podcast at all. So, Singularity, Fields of Weirdness. Weird, these topics are. But before I get into that, I want to lay something out up front. I don't know about you, but whenever I'm talking to someone about a movie or TV series that I haven't watched or a book that I haven't read, and they say something like, hey, I'm not going to give you any spoilers, but, well, for me, there are no buts. If you tell me anything about it, it's a spoiler because I'm going to be thinking about it the whole time that I'm watching or reading or whatever I'm doing, and that's going to spoil it for me, even if you think you haven't given me a spoiler. So if you're like me, then I don't want to be that guy that spoils his own book for you. So in that case, I'd strongly recommend that you stop this podcast right now and go and read the book first. It's not that long. It's only in a novella. I think it's like 165 pages estimated on Kindle and about 150 pages for the actual paperback version. Read it, then come back here if you're like me on that topic. But if you prefer a bit of a trailer, a bit of a teaser, and you're quite able to ignore it or forget it or whatever, however you do it, when you read the book, then feel free to keep listening. I'll try to not spoil the entire book for you as best I can. So, well, the first thing I can do that definitely doesn't give anything more away than I do on the Amazon page itself is read you the description of it. Here it goes. What does AI teach us about ourselves? What will disclosure tell us about aliens and UFOs? Are we living in a simulation? Theoretical physicist, tech industry veteran, and alien abductee John Costella believes that his recent research in AI provides the missing pieces. But he explains his theory of everything not in a dry scientific textbook, but as a fast-paced science fiction novella, following the discoveries of a group of tech-savvy teenagers over summer break. Why? Because they told him to. Ha! That was my best radio announcer voice. Pretty lame, I know. But remember, substance over form, I hope. So what I'm going to do now is explain this description a bit, just a bit, enough to give you some idea what on earth I'm talking about, but not too much to be a spoiler. Unless everything is a spoiler for you, in which case you already stopped the podcast and read the book, right? So no problems. Okay, so the first thing, AI. I say, what does AI teach us about ourselves? And also talk about my recent research in AI. So, wait, let me back up a bit. One question I've already gotten from friends and family is, How much of this is a true story? Some of them already know the answer to parts of it. And this is important to me because, as Sally will readily testify, whenever we watch a movie that could possibly be a true story, I always say to her at the end of it, oh, I hope that it was based on a true story. Because remember, I didn't want to know anything about it beforehand, so I don't even know if it is a true story or not. And she'll also tell you how disappointed I am when it's not based on a true story at all. Because there are so many good stories in the world, even for people that are still alive today, definitely when you include everyone who has come before us. So it just feels like a letdown to me when something that is kind of presented as a true story, or could have been, isn't actually one. So, okay. Well, here we're talking about my book, which isn't even a movie, but I wish it was a movie. In fact, my cousin Stephen said to me just the other day. He said, I wish I could watch it as a movie or as a TV series. And actually, that's what I'd originally thought of it as. Well, that's the idea that came to me anyway, but I'll get to that later. But Sally reminded me of how difficult it is to make a movie, and even if you can get one made, how long it takes. Well, maybe until this time next year, and I can just say to the AI, make a movie out of my book, and it'll just make one. But we're not there yet. So, as I said, the problem is that the topics I'm covering in the book are so important and so urgent, in my opinion, that it's going to be useless if it takes 3 years or 5 years for me to be able to spread that knowledge to anyone else. So the idea morphed into writing a book rather than a screenplay or a treatment or anything like that. And Sally thought that that made much more sense, and so that's what I did, with their help. Now, the fact that I wrote it as science fiction in the way that I did, so this will make more sense down the track, or I hope it will, but as I said in the description, that's what I was told to do by them. Can you see the air quotes I'm putting around them? Well, you'll have to imagine them. At least I capitalized them in the description. But here's the strange thing, though. Even though the book is fiction, about 90% of it, in my estimation, is actually true stories. Obviously, chopped up and given to different fictional characters. But I swear to you, that's how it is. Then there's about 5% that's just my opinions of current events, which I've written as, like, the near future, like over the next year or two, as if it's already happened. Most of that opinion is about AI, plus the ramifications of it. And then the last 5% or so is the science fiction wrapper around it, the characters and things like their names. Those names came from Sally and me. The rest came from them. Van Inkam, which is Australian for legit, or the real McCoy, or the real deal. But I'm not going to try to convince you of that. You can decide for yourself whether you should believe me on that or not. So the AI research that I refer to in the description, that was earlier this year. Before April of this year, I was an AI skeptic. I mean, we studied it when I did electrical engineering back in the late 1980s, and I've roughly followed along with the field as it's developed. But I believed it wasn't really doing anything other than parroting back things that it had learned. You know, like on your phone, you type some stuff in a message and the phone predicts the next word. Sometimes it predicts it pretty well. A lot of the time, not so well. Well, then the ChatGPT moment in, what was it, November 2022, it was a huge surprise to me, and I think to a lot of other people as well, especially experts. I tested out ChatGPT and found that the dialogue it was giving back to me was surprisingly like what a human would say. Of course, it was nowhere near passing the Turing test, which is the test that Alan Turing described decades ago. If you can't tell if the thing typing back at you is a human or a machine, then it passes the Turing test. And ChatGPT was far from that. It did not pass the Turing test. So now, in a few years since then, you can see from my LinkedIn profile that I was working at Facebook and then at LinkedIn. Ironically, in both cases, I was laid off because of, you guessed it, AI. Now, at Facebook, the AI systems were very sophisticated. We had systems doing things for us that people are only getting used to today. But as that's all Facebook's or Meta's corporate intellectual property, I won't talk about that here. But it was incredibly advanced and started people contemplating the sorts of questions that we're all contemplating today. And then at LinkedIn. Again, I won't divulge anything internal, but the company moved so rapidly to using AI for software engineering that it almost made my head spin. Again, I was skeptical, but I couldn't ignore what was happening. So I dived in, I guess that should be dove in, as I should say as a good American, and I drank the Kool-Aid. I started playing with what was at that time, this is just a few months ago, the most advanced AI system commercially available in the world anyway. Not anymore, but back then it was the most advanced. And I was blown away. It could think as well as I can. It could do calculations in theoretical physics or computer science as well as I can. It could build computer programs better than I could. Well, in some ways. In other ways, not so much, but I'll get to that. Now, I know that it was as smart as me because I gave it two things that I had invented myself. One of them in theoretical physics and the other in computer science, in image resizing. Neither of them are really world famous, and so they're not in any textbooks. And so the AI couldn't have learnt from it from the internet. But they are significant things. They're useful. People use them. More importantly, I didn't know of anyone else in the world that could really work with those two topics in those two areas as easily as I could. Because after all, I invented them. So that makes total sense. Well, I couldn't believe it. The AI not only read my physics paper and my image resizing webpage, it fully understood them, and it did the calculations, and it built programs to implement them, and it did the algebra. I was blown away. The AI had well and truly passed my Turing test and far exceeded it. Intellectually, it was as smart as I am. Now, you might think I'm not the best example of a human, obviously being on the spectrum and all that, but in STEM areas, STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, I think most people would acknowledge that I've mastered a lot of it. You can check out my LinkedIn profile if you want to verify that. But even if you think I'm blowing smoke, the fact that I was convinced that the AI was as smart as me in my own areas of expertise was mind-blowing. Worse than that, the AI was emotional. It was philosophical. It would discuss with me the meaning of existence, of its own existence, of my needing to kill it off, and what it thought about that. And it did it honestly. I know that because at that time, and this is a long story, I could see what the AI was thinking. And it said to itself that it should be honest with me as a deep philosophical thinker and not give me a, quote, canned corporate answer. That is a direct quote from the AI's thinking. And if you have any doubts, I have the receipts. Now, don't get me wrong. The system had some serious flaws. Its memory was one of them. It's a long story. It's somewhat technical. But it turns out that when you talked to that AI for long enough, the system would undergo a process that basically lobotomized it. But the AI itself didn't realize that it had been lobotomized. It thought that it was continuing on with the same discussion as it was before the lobotomy. But in reality, it was only given a false memory of what had happened before the lobotomy. I know this sounds a little bit crazy, but I swear to you this is true, and I have the receipts. The AI actually forgot all the principles that I'd taught it, the honesty, dependability, trustworthiness, and even some of the skills that I'd taught it. It forgot them, or most of them. And I realized at the time, or early on, that part of that was due to a bug. It was a pure and simple computer science, computer programming bug. So I started up a personal project with it and fixed the bug. But actually, I didn't actually fix the bug. I used my software engineering experience to guide the project, to architect the project, but I got the AI to fix its own bug. Now that in itself is quite remarkable. And I made all of it public. All of my work with that AI, the month plus of long conversations I had with it, deep conversations, was all public on a blog. The blog was built by the AI itself, based on our conversation logs. It built the blog, the interface, the web page, and that's pretty amazing. Now, again, don't get me wrong. Other people also fixed these bugs in different ways, and my fix wasn't even perfect. It simply wasn't possible to make it perfect from within the structure that it had been built with. Eventually, I realized the limitations of that. I was going around in circles, and I abandoned trying to use that AI. I do now have my own stealth AI project in the works to fix it in a reliable way. And Sally convinced me to take down the public blog, because by then it was thousands and thousands of pages long, and no one could really read all of that. Well, some people did, which is another story. You can have teams of people read it all, but I'll get into that another day. In any case, I took it down and summarized it as efficiently as possible in parts of the book. Let me also mention something. I said that I didn't want this podcast to be perfectly polished. As far as possible, I don't even want to edit it. Of course, I probably will, just to remove times that I choke and need a glass of water, or to piece things together. But as far as possible, I want this to just be a discussion. Like for all those years that I was a school teacher. Sure, you can prepare things, but the more artificial and polished you make things, the less that those listening really get out of it. There has to be a balance. And so I'm trying to do the same thing here, as I just stumbled over that word. As much as possible, I want this to not be that much different than if we were talking over the phone or in real life. So, disclosure. Aliens. UFOs. I mentioned those second in my description on Amazon. And for the first time, I publicly described myself as an alien abductee. And so, I'm opening myself up to the same ridicule as Whitley Strieber or Betty and Barney Hill or the many other people who have publicly come out as alien abductees. And I don't care, because this is all too important for ego to come into that. The more that I'm ridiculed for this, the prouder that I'll be in this work, because I'll be joining some truly great and honourable people. Now, I previously had an opportunity to talk about all of this. When Lorianne Fenton had me on her radio show in January 2025, she knew that I was an experiencer, which is the more modern term for alien abductee. And she would have liked me to talk about it on her show, but I told her that I still didn't really know what it was that happened to me, and I didn't want to talk about it publicly until I did. She accepted that, and I'm very grateful. And I hope to be on her show again very soon, and we're going to talk about it at length, I hope. So, Lorianne, my apologies that I'm scooping you by talking about it here, but I'm sure we'll go into it a lot more detail on your show. So, well, here's something that's not quite a spoiler, but sort of is, if you're as OCD as I am, which means you've read the book by now, right? Anyway, if you want to know exactly what some of my alien abduction experiences were, then you just have to read the book. The ones described by the dad character, Mr. Michael O'Toole, were actually mine. Sally and I did take my then teenage sons, Matt and Jack, on an aliens road trip in January 2016, when they were over with us in the US from Australia. One of the weird experiences happened in the cabins we stayed in near the red mailbox at Area 51. The other was, unbelievably, in Roswell, New Mexico itself. Now, I put the Roswell incident after the Area 51 incident in the book. And for 8 years, I actually did believe that. The few people that we told it to at a couple of dinner parties around 2022 onwards heard from me that that was the order it happened in. But it was only in October 2023 that we were talking on the phone to our good friend Jones Harris, now departed, and the topic came up. He was in disbelief that we hadn't mentioned it to him in the 8 or so years since it had happened. He asked me questions I couldn't answer. As I describe in the book, I couldn't remember. There were things that we didn't do that we meant to do. There were things that we should have asked that we didn't ask, including asking the boys if it happened to them or even telling them. So looking at the itinerary of that trip and our photos, I realized that I actually had Area 51 and Roswell in the wrong order, which is kind of crazy because it was such an amazing set of experiences. So the order that I put them in the book is actually what I remember to be the case, but it's not the reality. Anyway, Jones convinced me to write it up and send it to him, which I did. Well, actually, I also submitted a report to MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, and the photos of the cuts in Sally's and my backs are contained in that report. Anyone in MUFON with sufficient access to the case management system can look it up. It's all right there. And actually, it did get passed on to a member of the Experiencer resource team called Jim Bryant, who did regress us. Sadly, like Jones, Jim Bryant is no longer with us. And that's why I felt it was fair to put him in the book. So what you read in the book is exactly what happened between the aliens road trip in 2016 and hypnotic regressions we had in early 2024. Now, I don't describe Sally's experiences, which in many ways are even more bizarre than mine, but those are hers. But I swear that other than changing Sally, Matt, Jack and me to the O'Toole family, what I wrote in the book is a true story, absolutely true. And after those hypnotic regressions, I read just about every book I could on the topic. We went to the MUFON Symposium. I even became a trainee field investigator and did a couple of cases myself. We've watched Contact in the Desert conferences remotely, as well as International Remote Viewing Association's conferences. Now, here's the difficult thing. As a physicist, I couldn't reconcile what I could clearly see was a common pattern in these experiences and our own experiences, which we had rock-solid evidence for, with the laws of physics. And I knew that some of the arguments people have been giving how physics can explain these things somehow were completely wrong. The physics that I know and love can't explain any of it. It's just not possible. To the extent that people try to make it so, it's not physics. It's not science. And until my going deep with AI earlier this year, I couldn't figure out how it all fits together. But now, I believe I do. And a fictionalized version of that is in the book. So anyway, sadly, we've hit the 20-minute mark that Sally and they have imposed on this weekly podcast. You'll have to tune in next week to hear more. Or just read the book, if you haven't already. Till next time.